The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
So once more into the Lojong teachings, into this study and practice from the Zen perspective, and I think from many Buddhist traditions, these teachings are actually not something outside of us. But the purpose of these teachings is to remind us or help us clarify what we know to be true for ourselves. So the point is not to see how much you can remember, but the point is to notice what resonates with you. Some phrase or word or perspective that reminds you of the truth of your life, not the truth of Buddhism, but what is actually so in your experience. Because all of these teachings come from the lived experience of human beings. People just like you and I, who have sat in meditation and have done all kinds of practices, really looking into this great matter. And of course, everyone is looking into this great matter. We've been talking, appreciating some the sangha of people here in this the meditation hall of Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts, and people all around who are aware of this retreat and joining in some way, including everyone who might be listening to this talk at some later date. This sangha of practice, all of us together. And the sangha of practice is, of course, all human beings. Ultimately, this is not a sectarian enterprise. One student I know reports his discussion with a teacher, and the student said, "I'm not really sure if I can call myself a Buddhist." And the teacher, Zen Buddhist teacher, said, "Well, I'm not sure if I can call myself a Buddhist either. So maybe we shouldn't call ourselves Buddhists. Whatever we do becomes another identity that wants to solidify." So Zen students, Tibetan students, Buddhists, Christians, Muslims, pagans, atheists, all of us on this same path, all of us breathing in, breathing out, all of us finding our way. And so these Lojong teachings, the 7 points and 59 slogans, after many days on the trail here, we are actually up to point four. We're making great progress. And as we go through these, we've been appreciating there's some sequential quality that's quite lovely, and yet they all circle back. You may hear themes from the beginning repeated, and in fact it is necessary to circle back again and again. And we've been inspired by Norman Fisher's wonderful book, Training and Compassion, as well as by other texts. But at this point in Norman's text, he actually consciously circles back to point one, resolve to begin. And the point four is make practice your whole life. Make practice your whole life, and such a wonderful encouragement. encouragement to us that this formal practice we do, this sitting in this upright and dignified posture, spending long periods of time in this silence and stillness, is just one form of practice. Once after a retreat that Melissa and I had led, someone said, well, how much practice do you recommend? How much daily practice should we do after this retreat? I said, 24 hours. 24 hours you should practice, I should practice. This practice of investigating, this practice of awareness, this practice of returning. In this practice, and the slogan we're going to look at today is number 18, practice for death as well as for life. And this does bring us back to the point number one, resolve to begin, train in the preliminaries. And the 4 points of the preliminaries, which are actually not preliminaries, are these remembrances, we might say. This encouragement to remember that the rarity and preciousness of human life, that although quite difficult and troublesome at times, to be born a human being is a rare opportunity. When the Buddha addressed his disciples, he said, courageous and blessed bodhisattvas, courageous for being on the path, and blessed to have been born a human, to be aware, to have heard these teachings. So we have all heard something. We are all on the trail of something. Like a good hound dog, we catch a scent, and it excites our heart, and we head off. My teacher, George Bowman, used to have a bulldog named Eshin, and I sat with him sometimes down in the mountains of Kentucky, and the beautiful Dharma Hall in the middle of the woods, and Eshin, the bulldog, would be sitting with us as we were sitting, and in the middle of the stillness, Eshin would pick her head up and sniff and go tearing out into the woods, and it could be the middle of the night, but she would catch a scent of something, something that made her heart leap and her great stocky body take it off into the woods, crashing. She never came back with anything. I was always kind of relieved. But I always admired her. Of course, she would do this for the UPS truck, too. So she wasn't too discriminate in her adventuring. But she had a wonderful spirit. And when she clamped on to something, she clamped onto it. Unfortunately, one day she clamped onto the wheel of the UPS truck. Turns out that was not an auspicious thing to clamp onto. But she survived to dash off into the woods with only one eye from then on. But was not a problem for her. And in some way not a problem for us. All of us having grabbed on to many tire truck wheels, been taken round, pummeled within an inch of our life, and yet we come back for more. So this is the rarity and preciousness of human life. And then the second, and this is why I'm coming back here, the second reminder is the inevitability of death. The inevitability of death. There was actually a recent study of mortality rates. Turns out it's 100%. Every demographic, every religion, even people who eat only the right fruits and exercise as much as they should. No matter what. And this morning in our sutra service, we recited the piece from Tego Bowu, Days Like Lightning. The days and months go by like lightning. We should value the time. And so this reminder that at some point we will have to give up everything, not just the things we own, the things of this world, but to give up our self, give up this person who we think we are. So looking into this matter, practice for death as well as for life. So in some way, of course, we practice in order to live our life. We practice here on the cushion in order to move into the world, to dive into life, to dive into the particularness of our life and the particularness of our heart. We are not trying to become more calm. We are not trying to withdraw from the messiness of life, but we are practicing in order to dive into life as it is and to let everything teach us. These Lojong teachings so clear on everything is this teaching. And so we practice for life. We practice to cultivate fearlessness. We meet ourselves on the cushion in all our different and sometimes terrifying guises. We see self after self arise. It's not that there is no self. It's just that there's no abiding self. You are, or as Walt Whitman said, I am, I contain multitudes. Each one of us contains multitudes. Each one of us kind and cruel. Each one of us courageous and terrified. Each one of us contains everything in the whole universe. And here on the cushion, we're encouraged to not know, to meet ourself as we are appearing in this moment, and this self that is appearing in this moment has never appeared in the world before. You may know who you have been up until this point. Of course, that's actually debatable. If you tell the story of your life to someone who knows you well, they may have slightly different perspectives. Wonderful sometimes to compare stories with siblings growing up, or with people we've been with a long time, and sometimes we wonder, did we actually grow up in the same family? We see how partial, but we have some sense of who we have been, where we have succeeded, where we have failed, where we get stuck. And so we have some sense of that, but we don't know who we will be in the next moment. So whenever we say something about ourselves, I am an impatient person, we might more accurately say, up until this moment, I have been an impatient person. Leaving open that possibility. And so practicing for life is practicing to appreciate possibility, to leap into the next self, to embody fully what the moment is requiring of us, embody this self, and then to let that self go as the next one arises. And so this leads us to this practicing for death, practicing with death. Death on so many levels. And one experience of death is this moment after moment. So early this morning, I was quite calm. I was doing quite well, and then later this morning, I'm lost and confused. Or maybe the other way around. This morning I was exhausted and foggy, and now I am bright and clear. Where did the foggy one go? Where did the clear one go? Moment after moment, there is appearing and disappearing. Our great teacher Dogen said that the teaching is that 72,000 times a second the self appears and disappears. That actually there is not a substance. There is this flashing moment after moment. Like Melissa described so wonderfully about the movies, it's actually still pictures. The pictures are not moving, but they come so quickly. So we are living and dying, coming into being and fading away so quickly we cannot perceive it. But we can perceive, and often it is quite painful, the losses of this life. As we grow older, the loss of flexibility or energy or memory. Things I used to be able to do, I can't do now. The loss of situations, of jobs, of relationships, as we move through life. Things that we thought would last forever, it turns out don't. And this is, although we know it on some level, is quite a surprise. And so this inevitability of death is the inevitability in life of losing what we have. We will lose what we have. And so from this moment-to-moment perspective, we can practice dying. Practice this kind of generosity, we might say, of whatever arises, we hold it lightly. Whether we think it is good or not good, whether it is pleasant or unpleasant, we are practicing a kind of openness of being. Where we are prepared to let whatever is here be here as long as it is here. And when it moves on, we don't have to go chasing after it. We say when it comes, don't try to avoid it. And when it leaves, don't go chasing after it. And of course, as we sit, we can begin to see how we do exactly the opposite. How we resist some things. I don't want this. I don't want this. And how when some state begins to change, we can cling to it. And this clinging is not just to the good. You'd think that we would only cling to positive states, but as we become more intimate, we can see that even our difficult places, we become quite attached to. I'm quite used to feeling anxious. And when the anxiety starts to subside, or when I am in a place of calm, I become anxious that I'm not anxious. Or I become afraid that I'm not afraid. Wherever we are begins to have a momentum and The part of us that is always trying to create a self thinks, okay, well, this is who I am, and we solidify, we make a house out of it. I am the one who, fill in the blank, and it may be a leaky, drafty house falling apart, being eaten by termites, but it's my house, and we defend it. So we can't stop doing this, but we can see. We can pay attention and notice all of these things. This is not a practice of trying to change. It is quite impossible to change at some level from an act of will. But one of the reasons we go back and again, back again and again to this resolve to begin this remembering how urgent and important this is, remembering what it is we want. If you want to wake up, you need to remember that you want to wake up. If you want to find freedom, to find this liberation, if you want to align with this deepest part of yourself, you must, I must, again and again, go back to this deepest part, this remembering. What do you love? In this awareness of the brevity, the impermanence of life in this brief time, what do you want to give yourself to? What is worth spending your life for? Each one of us, make no mistake, is spending our life. And what we give energy to will increase. It will grow and unfold. And so as we give energy toward what it is we love, what it is that is alive, and this is not an intellectual matter. Like Eshin the bulldog, she did not lie there thinking and making things up, but was alive to the sense that was in her being. And each one of us is here today because something in your being, something in your heart, has sensed something, has tasted, seen, heard, felt some deep sensation of wanting to see clearly. And we say to see clearly into this great matter, and the great matter is life and death. We say life as if death were separate. We say death as if life were separate. In our translation in the sutra book of some of Dogen's writings, I think it was Josh who encouraged us to have hyphens. So it's not life and death. It's life dash and dash death. Life and death. Life and death. This is what we are exploring. And this is what reminds us of the urgency. And so we practice dying. And maybe one Zen koan to conclude here, the wonderful one, perhaps one of my, certainly one of my favorites in the whole collection, is the student who comes to the teacher and he says, heat and cold descend on us. What shall we do? He might have said, sometimes I'm clear and sometimes I'm not clear. But he said, the heat and cold descend on us. What should we do? And the teacher says, well, why don't you go to the place where it's neither hot nor cold? Kind of a Zen wise guy response, I think. But also a genuine question. So where is the place? And this is what the student said. He said, well, where is the place where it's neither hot nor cold? Where is the place where I'm not troubled by this fluctuation of life? And the teacher said, when it's hot, let the heat kill you. And when it's cold, let the cold kill you. So this let the heat kill you, or let the heat burn you, and let the cold freeze you. We die in some way by giving ourselves to the moment, by entering beyond our opinion. So then when discomfort is here, can we find this intimacy where we're not standing outside complaining? Norman Fisher talks quite wonderfully several points in his book about cutting through the whining and complaining. We always want it different somehow. More of this. So I want more sitting. No, I want less sitting. I want more walking. I want faster. I want slower. But we are practicing, and we are invited to cut through this, to meet whatever is here. And the teaching that whatever is here is exactly what you need, and that the freedom comes from giving up the commentary and meeting in the suchness of the moment, meeting with this kind of intimacy that involves courage and love and curiosity. And then we are the Buddha, the frozen Buddha. We are the burning Buddha. We are the sad Buddha. We are the calm Buddha. And we manifest the whole universe in the particular, through the particular, that is right here. And in this moment, our koan is in resolution. There is no problem because there is no distance. Everything is here. The great Dharma body is the whole universe. And so this is how we practice dying to our opinion again and again. And when we fully die to the moment, when we fully come alive in the moment, then we are reborn. Not through our own great efforts, but we are reborn because this is the nature of the universe. This absolute compassion, this aliveness, this great functioning that the ancient worthies sang of, this great functioning that is supporting you already. But we get to give ourselves to this, and then we are reborn as a better version so that we can die again and be reborn again and again and again. Thank you. So please sit comfortably. Reminder that we are recording these, and that if you would like to say something with the recorder off, please let us know and we can turn it off. And I'm David.
Melissa.
I'm Laura.
Jenny.
Ray.
Esther.
Susan.
Fabian.
Henry.
Steve.
Todd.
Meredith.
Andy.
Mike.
Tab. Debbie.
So this is a time for our dialogue, Dharma dialogue, for comments or questions about this talk, this point, or about practice.
Kinds of divisions in it. So, and I
you know, sort of, because my mind wants to make categories for things, I tend to think, oh, this is better than that, I should do it this rather than that. But it takes effort for me to realize that everything is practice, because it means that I have to pay attention. I can't let myself off the hook. You know,
here's the thing, even when you're not paying attention, that's also practice. Right? You know, right. There's no escape from this. And it reminds me that, you know, the analogy is that, so everything is the Buddha nature, the awakened heart, and we all are, but we don't know it. So there's parts of our daily practice that we don't recognize as practice, just the way human beings are. So this kind of a talk and reminder and coming together and being reminded and going to Dokusan and being reminded, that's, we need, and reading books, whatever, we need that. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, remember, sati, the word in Pali for mindfulness, really means to remember, because we forget. We just lose it. So it's not equal to paying attention. But it is, it's kind of, for me, it's this, oh, right, quality. Oh, yeah, this too. Mm-hmm. Could it be this too? Yep, that's the teaching. Yeah, and you can feel the mind going, but wait a minute, because we love to make categories. Yeah. I think it's really important to name that.
Yeah, okay. Great, thanks. Yeah.
Thank you, David. I'm stuck on some stuff about time and urgency right now, and I was reading part of the book last night, and in part of it he said something along the lines of, if you're 30, you might think that your life is a third done, but in fact it's 80% over. I kind of vacillate between these things of urgency that kind of drag us in this way to do things kind of quickly or to feel fear. And then I also kind of struggle with this idea about time and how important the way that we measure it is. And I remember I worked in East Africa, and I worked with a lot of Somalis who came from really rural areas. And in the work I did, we would have to interview them about when they were born, and they would have no idea what that even meant, because they didn't use time, which was fascinating, because I had no idea how to explain it. And so we didn't explain it. What we did do is we just assign a birth date, which is January 1st. So if you ever encounter Somalis,
we'll know who gave them their birthday.
I didn't get to choose. This was kind of assigned if they were to be resettled in the U.S. And so they were all assigned this same birth date. And if they didn't know, some of them, you know, there would be like a really tall boy, and they would say, yes, he's 3 years old. And I said, well, I don't really think so. And so we would have to kind of
negotiate.
Use this strange discretion. And so, you know, the way, and then if they had a bunch of children, which a lot of them had really large families, we would just do a year and a half in between every child. Mm-hmm. And so all of these ways that we are fitting them into this time, and I prefer the Somali, you know, rural way, because I don't really understand. I understand its importance in this, but I guess I'm just asking for some reflections from you guys about time, about urgency, about this matter.
Well, of course, we can only speak part of the story. So I really love you bringing this up, because how long is 25 minutes when you're sitting here? Right? It can be a year and a half is what I think. And so there's a way that all this talk about time is actually not true. It's not true that your life is 80% or 30% or 50%. The truth is, we don't know, but we do know you are alive now. And all of space and time is right here. The eons before, beginningless life, right? To say I was born at this time is, I love that there are people in the world who realize that does not make any difference and is not true. That's a story. That's one of these narratives of the nuisance brain creates, right? So how to hold it both ways, you know, how in some ways to realize, yeah, at some point we will not be sitting here, right? And then we can feel the preciousness, but then it can get into, oh my God, I'm going to stay up late tonight, and you know, and then that becomes the new nuisance mind, right? And this is like the antidote to that. There is all the time in the world. There is no, what is this? How could there be urgency or not urgency? And so we appreciate both of those and more. So thank you so much. Such an important that our practice doesn't become unbalanced, because then we become hard and brittle and get lost in that. And on the other side, we can get, oh yeah, well, whatever, I don't really, I'll say, you know, so this middle way is actually, yeah.
And as GP, I think that's really the thing that comes up. If I go, oh no, you guys will sit here for so long. You know?
Yeah. Oh yeah, she's in Somali time.
Yeah. For so long, so it's just very present for me.
Yeah. Do you want to?
Oh, a number of things occur to me. I mean, I think you got Laura's point here, but you know, there's consensual reality also. Mm-hmm. You know, the planet really is revolving, and there's day and night, and so, you know, just what David was saying, there's that back and forth, because you could also just keep doing 2-minute rounds, and some of us would feel like those were 25-minute rounds, and we'd feel like, oh, my practice is getting better. Time just passes. That's amazing. And my legs don't even fall asleep anymore. So cool. So you know, it is both. And this is the thing. There's consensual reality, and there's this emptiness world. And different cultures do that differently. As you said, the Somali. I always am reminded when I lived in Peru with Peruvian Indians, and I spoke Spanish and they spoke Spanish, but we were both speaking Spanish as a second language because they spoke Quechua and I was an English speaker. And we had a lot of misunderstandings, but one of them was about time, because apparently in Quechua, from what I understood, there's no conjugation that involves the past being over. So they knew when they were born, you know, they knew about years and months and everything, but you never would say, I went to the market. You would always say, I was going to the market, or I will be going to the market, but the emphasis was on going, not gone. There was never any finality. And so when I never learned how to conjugate past tenses in Spanish because of that, because when I went back to school, my Spanish teachers were very frustrated with me because I would, and in fact, one woman from Argentina said, oh, you speak like an Indian. You know, right, there's this quality of just time is always, like everything that's happened in the past, everything that will happen in the future is happening. Right? It's a very different thing. And you know, I also think about Australian Aborigines who have a similar relationship to time, that it's not even personal. Things that happened millions of years ago are happening right now. So they call it the dream time, that their ancestors are alive and present. I love that. You know, so there's, and then, you know, so it's frustrating for Western cultures that are built on 9 o'clock means 9 o'clock. Even Southern European cultures, depending on the country, they 10 o'clock means maybe about 10:30. You know, people don't. So it's kind of wonderful, and we just have to check. You know, what's the agreement? That's why I call it consensual, because we all have to agree. If everybody agrees that there's no past, then that's great. But these people, the Somali refugees, colliding with this other culture, you know. So I think there's an analogy to Zen practice that we need to learn to be more and more flexible about every individual's culture, inner culture, because everybody's different about the way we perceive reality, and so we learn to adjust, you know, based on.
Yeah, great.
say, listen, Dan, the question is how much should I practice each day? And the answer is 24 hours. And the reality that it's all practice, whether we know it or not, and you get into this judging my practice and thinking, you know, I aspire to do this practice all the time and, like, not aware that, well, it is all practice. And this judging about, I don't know what I'm doing. It's, you know, I wish I could do it, versus an understanding that this is all it. And the bottom line is I really appreciate the subtleness of the Dharma. It's subtle beyond subtle.
Well, and the subtleness of the effort that's required. Because there is some effort required, but too much is not better. Right? And so, right, on one hand, everything is practice, and yet we can waste our life chasing things that aren't that important. So again, these two sides of practice, the rinzai, we might say, or the prajna, you know, yes, you know, really rouse yourself and do it, and the soto, the samadhi, the absorption, praying all the time. Why do I need to, you know, do anything else? You know, no effort required, but something is required, and what is it? To find that, you know, that middle way. Again, and I think that's the subtlety to do not doing.
Well, and there is the middle way, and there's also this net. So we're on a retreat right here. Everybody in the room is on retreat right now, and then there's parts of our life when we're not on retreat. And there's sitting upright and still, and then there's chopping carrots and apples and stirring oatmeal. You know, so there's this... So we sometimes talk about formal and informal, and in the Lojong teachings, we talk about meditation and post-meditation. That's the translation that's used by a lot of the Americans who talk about Lojong. So post-meditation is those other 23 and a half hours. But it's so even on retreat, there's the different forms. And I think just what Ray was saying, too, that we value, we judge. Right, you're making a similar point, not exactly the same point. This, not that, and so, and then the danger is, if it's all this, we can just say whatever. If there's no time, we can just say, you know, who cares about the timer? And it's both. So you know, this is the great teaching of Zen too. It is both, and it is neither, and it's both. And neither nor both. That's Nagarjuna said that, you know, and everybody went, at first you got to go, oh yeah, what? By the end, which is good.
So on that note, now that we've clarified the matter, let's have at it once more.